You found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Thank you, Linda O'Brien, and good morning. This is Maria Sanchez. We're live. It is Friday, July 26, 9 o'clock Pacific. We thank you so much for joining us, and we thank you for your continued show of support and obviously interest in what it is that we're offering to you. We got our numbers for June late last night. Thank you, Sam, for that. And we're hitting tens of thousands of you, and it's just fabulous to know that what we're looking to do, which is provide information in as unbiased and non-confrontational manner as possible, seems to be resonating. Before we get into the news, and we've got some good news, which is great, our guest this hour is from UNICEF. She is Claudia Kappa. She is the author of a study that was released this week from the United Nations Children's Agency of UNICEF. It's the largest report yet into the extent of female genital mutilation or cutting, and it shed new information onto the practice that affects tens of millions of women and girls worldwide. More than 125 million girls and women alive today have undergone some form of female genital mutilation in 29 countries, and if something isn't done, some 30 million other girls remain at risk of being cut in the next 10 years. So UNICEF has graciously provided Claudia to us, who wrote the study, and she's going to be visiting with us in just a little bit. But we try to focus on as much good news as possible, so this morning is no exception. Our consumer confidence sentiment in the United States rose in July this month to the highest level in 6 years as we Americans feel better about the current economic climate. So that survey was released this morning. It's the highest level since July 2007, and it says that it's pointing us toward a continuing expansion of consumer spending in the year ahead. And what's interesting about that is that we have a high level of confidence that we're headed in the right direction. We're also concerned that interest rates are going to go up, which probably they will, because as you know, they've been at historic lows, not necessarily a bad thing, but that we will go ahead and spend in spite of that. And in fact, because we're expecting that interest rates will rise, that is making us spend a little bit more because we want to take advantage of the low rates before that they go up. So the survey's barometer of current economic conditions also hit the highest level in 6 years on a final reading basis. So yay, good news. Happy Friday and have a great weekend. So the sexting scandal is still unfolding. New York mayoral candidate and sexter, they're calling him now, Anthony Weiner, admitted yesterday to having lewd online conversations with as many as three women since leaving Congress in 2011. He told reporters yesterday that he thinks he's had the racy online chats with a total of 6 to 10 women, with no more than three of them happening after he resigned from the House over that kind of conduct. So a new poll released yesterday shows the Democrat and one-time frontrunner has lost his lead. And his lead seems to be going towards the favor of the city council speaker, Christine Quinn's gain. The new poll numbers show that Quinn is leading by 25% among Democratic primary voters, compared with Weiner 16%. And that same poll last month showed Weiner leading by 5%. So the poll was conducted entirely since the details from Tuesday emerged, and the Democrat primary is set for September 10th. Almost half said Weiner's online sexual relationships would impact their vote, and almost three quarters said support from his wife would have no impact on how much they trusted him. This is from seasoned and jaded New Yorkers, by the way. Wiener did say yesterday that he's still working with people to get help dealing with his penchant for X-rated online flirting, but he disputes any suggestion that it's an addiction. So yesterday, apparently the gossip site The Dirty posted what it says is a lewd photo of Wiener that he sent to a woman last year. And the woman that was the object of his affections for part of that has done an exclusive interview with Inside Edition that's airing today. I saw a snippet of it. She says that she's disgusted by him. It makes me feel physically ill. He's not who I thought he was. She said that she and Wiener grew so close during their online fling, which began after he resigned from Congress and ended late last summer, that the politician even consulted with her before deciding to run for mayor. She's 22 years old, 23, depending on what reports you read. She said that Wiener described himself to her as an argumentative, perpetually horny, middle-aged man. Now, this affair, as best as I can tell, they never saw each other in person. It was all virtual. So, and she fell in love with him, and she said, I cared about him a lot. He was very important to me. And the Inside Edition's Jim Murray said, you told Anthony Wiener that you loved him? Yes, she replied. The question is, did he tell you he loved you? Yes, she replied. She said, Wiener said that he is like wanting to put her up in Chicago and doing all this kind of stuff. So this virtual relationship, I think, is somewhat troubling too. So she also said, I am extremely sorry for my part in the hurt and pain that she's obviously feeling right now. A crying Leathers said. That's Sydney Leathers, and she's referring to Wiener's wife, Uma or Huma, depending on how you say it. So also in New York politicians news is a statement from Sylvia Spitzer, who's Elliot Spitzer's wife. Page Six is reporting exclusively that she's telling friends she plans to divorce him. She said that they don't think that she's got attorneys yet, and she's never commented on his patronizing of prostitutes or their marriage. Silda is saying she's going to wait until this is all over. She's been telling friends this is too hard, this is too rough. So that election is November 5th. Page Six exclusively revealed in May that the Spitzers were living apart. And just yesterday, Elliot Spitzer, last night actually, he said that they are still a couple and that she will not be seen at his side. His quote is, I think it's fair to say I'm running for office. No other member of my family is running for office. And I think the public is going to judge me, not who else is with me or not with me. She's got her career. There are other things I think the public appreciates. I'm out here fighting every day for them. And then we have more sex news with an elected official. And this is the San Diego mayor. More women have come forward. Yesterday, four women publicly identified themselves as targets of Mayor Bob Filner's unwanted sexual advances. The latest accusers spoke with KPBS, which is the local PBS station there in San Diego. The third one spoke, and now a fourth one. And these are hard-charging, high-placed women. So the total of victims accusing Filner of sexual harassment stands at seven as of late yesterday. Meanwhile, the San Diego County Democratic Party Central Committee voted last night 34-6 to ask the city's first Democratic mayor in 20 years to leave office. This is 1 week after the committee deadlocked 24-24 on the question. So the woman who came forward Thursday are a retired Navy Rear Admiral, a dean at San Diego State University, the head of the San Diego Ports Tenants Association, and a prominent businesswoman. So the retired Rear Admiral and the city's chief operating officer under Filner's predecessor told KPBS that Filner once blocked a doorway after others had left a meeting, ran his finger up her cheek, and asked if she had a man in her life. When she told him she did have a man and named him Lyndon Blue, Filner allegedly replied, oh, of the Blues Brothers? And then he says, maybe we can get together sometime and have lunch and he can support me from mayor. So her name is Veronica Ronnie Froman. She said the incident happened a couple of years ago at Filner's congressional office. Next up, Sharon Bernie Cloward, president of the San Diego Port Tenants Association, said the then congressman approached her at an event in 2010, said she was beautiful, and that he wanted to date her after his reelection. At another event last year during the mayoral campaign, she said Filner groped me on my backside inappropriately. Her quote, "I was left there startled and fearful. In fact, I actually had someone walk me to my car that night." The businesswoman in San Diego's tourism and hospitality industry, who has known Filner since before he was elected to Congress in 1992, Patty Roscoe, said Filner placed her in a headlock numerous times and tried to kiss her on the lips. Her quote, "I'd have to squirm to get away, and just as recently as a few months ago, this happened. I turned, and he just slobbered down my chin." Finally, Joyce Gaddis, dean of San Diego State's College of Professional Studies and Fine Arts, said she had a series of interactions with Bob, here's her quote, "where he held me too tight, a kiss on the cheek, which is inappropriate, hands on the knees that last too long." So yesterday, Filner refused to discuss the allegations when he was hounded by reporters at a public appearance. His quote, "let's take a deep breath, let that process work itself out. Meanwhile, we got a city to run." So not looking good. Boy, that's, and so in light of the good news that we shared, sorry for some of that bad news. And finally, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder wrote a letter dated July 23rd of this week, so 3 days ago, and it was released on Friday, that was sent to Russia to say that Edward Snowden would not face the death penalty or be tortured and would have all the protections of the U.S. civilian court system if he were sent home. So that was revealed this morning as well. We've got other news, but we're going to get the author of the study of the UNICEF report, Claudia Kappa, on the line now to talk with us about the report. Claudia, good afternoon to you. This is Maria Sanchez. You're live on the program. Thank you so much for making the time to be available with us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Maria.
You're welcome. Claudia is a statistics and monitoring specialist at UNICEF, and prior to joining UNICEF, she was working at the University of Geneva and at the Institute for Social Studies of the International Labor Organization. Claudia holds a master's and a PhD in development studies from the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Switzerland. And before we go into the details of the report, Claudia, and what UNICEF is saying about it and what the United Nations did unanimously in December of last year, would you let our listeners know what exactly it means, female genital mutilation or cutting?
Mm-hmm. Female genital mutilation and cutting refers to the total or partial removal of female genital parts for non-medical reasons. It is a practice that has been in place in certain countries for centuries, and it's mainly concentrated in Africa and the Middle East.
And what is the reason behind the procedure or the justification?
Most women report that a benefit for a girl to undergo female genital mutilation and cutting is because of social acceptance. As I said earlier, this is a very old and entrenched tradition in the 29 countries in Africa and the Middle East where female genital mutilation remains concentrated. So it's part of a long-term tradition that has been taken, that's been in effect for many centuries, and therefore the cutting is a normal act. It's expected of women to cut their daughters.
Now, when you say cut, can you describe, because I know there's variations on the procedure, and one that is probably the most invasive or radical is known as infibulation. Can you describe the severity of it to us, please?
Mm-hmm. Infibulation refers to the total cutting of the female genital parts, including the labia, and they are later on sealed. So, and this can take place with or without the excision of the clitoris. Infibulation is very common in countries like Somalia, for instance, where 63% of girls have been infibulated.
So they cut off the labia, they may or may not cut off the clitoris, and then they sew the opening closed?
Yes. They just leave a small hole that can be reopened for sexual intercourse and childbirth. And this is a procedure that is known as deinfibulation. And in some instances, this is followed again by a sort of reinfibulation.
And Claudia, how old are the girls when this procedure is performed, and under what circumstances is the surgery performed?
In most of the country, the majority of girls are cut before they reach the age of 5. In some contexts, like Mauritania, they're normally cut during the first week of life. In other countries, the cutting takes place between the ages of 5 and the ages of 14. It's very uncommon that the practice is done in late adolescence. For instance, there are a few instances where the cutting takes place when a girl is 16, 17, or 18, but these are rare cases. It's normally done by what are called traditional practitioners, traditional cutters, mm-hmm. normally women in the villages that have been taking care of the procedures from one generation to the next, if you want. It's only in few countries like Egypt or Sudan where the cutting is done by medical professionals, in most cases doctors. In Egypt, 77% of girls who have undergone some form of female genital mutilation and cutting were cut by a health personnel. And even in the cases of Egypt, where it's medicalized, most of the procedures still take place at home.
And is it sanitary, and are they using scalpels and surgical instruments?
Absolutely not. In most cases, the procedure is done with a razor, for instance, or a blade. It's done without anesthetic, and in most cases in very poor sanitary condition, which obviously increase the risks associated with the practice, like, for instance, infections.
And does this hole that they leave allow for menstrual cycles?
Yes, it is meant to allow for menstrual cycles and urinating, but it still has an impact on your ability to urinate, for instance, because it might take up to 15 minutes to empty the bladder. And these are the results of specific anthropological and clinical studies that were conducted with women who had undergone the procedure. Some of them were asked some of the consequences, a health consequence related to the practice. And unfortunately, this is very sad, most women consider these consequences normal because mm-hmm. all the women around them mm-hmm. also need 15 minutes, for instance, to empty their bladder. So they think that this is absolutely normal only because they've experienced this since they were very young. So they don't have a reference, an alternative, if you want, reference to consider these as being unacceptable consequences of the practice.
So does that mean the urethra is cut, or it's just mean that it's hidden once they stitch it closed?
It's hidden when they stitch it closed, yeah.
Wow. So according to what I read, there on the planet today, there are more than 125 million girls and women that have undergone some form of female genital mutilation.
Correct. This refers to the 29 countries in Africa and the Middle East where the practice is concentrated. The global number is likely to be slightly higher because the practice is also found in other contexts. Like, for instance, we have anecdotal evidence of the practice being performed in Colombia, in Malaysia, Indonesia, but also in some European and North American countries where it might take place among immigrant communities that are of origins in the countries where FGMC remain concentrated.
So the overview then is that because this practice is centuries old and the 29 countries that still participate in it, that's normal for them, is what you're saying. Because my understanding is that, like Egypt, 90% of the girls and women have been cut.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's astounding to me. That's almost everybody.
Absolutely. The practice is universal in countries like, for instance, Somalia, Guinea, Djibouti, and Egypt. In these countries, more than 90% of girls and women of reproductive age have undergone some form of cutting. So if you think about Somalia, we are talking about 98%. This means essentially everybody, all women in Somalia have undergone this procedure. And in countries where the practice is, where the prevalence is lower, you might find within the country some areas where FGMC, female genital mutilation or cutting, does not exist. There are certain communities, even within a certain country, that do not practice at all the cutting of the girls. But in the same country, you might have a region, a specific ethnic group, where the practice is universal. I want to take the example of Senegal. Senegal is a country where, at the national level, 26% of girls and women of reproductive age have undergone some form of cutting. 26% means essentially one in four.
Mm-hmm.
But then within the country, you have certain regions, like the region of Matam or Tabakunda, where you have more than 90% of girls and women who have undergone female genital mutilation. And in certain ethnic groups, the practice is universal. So it's also very important to look at the practice of female genital mutilation, not only across countries, but within countries as well.
Now, I traveled to Senegal in November of 2008, and I went with a women's group where we dug a well for a community so that they could have water 12 months of the year. And they are a polygamous. They can have up to four wives. But female genital mutilation never once ever came out in our discussions with the women in the village. So I know that they had horrible reproductive health care and hardly ever had access to physicians and things like that. But I'm surprised that at least somebody didn't mention it. So I don't know if they looked at us as Westerners and thought, well, we can't go there, or if because it's so prevalent that it's like that wouldn't be something to discuss because it happens to all of us.
Well, it can be a different factors at the same time. Obviously, these are very sensitive topics to talk about. This pertains to sexuality, and it's a very private matter to discuss. It's also the case in some countries where there have been a lot of campaigns, and still women have not made the transition. The shift in attitudes have not taken place. Women might feel they don't want to share what they actually think or they have experienced because they fear that this may have repercussions for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an easy topic to discuss, particularly in countries where there have been a lot of campaigns to talk about the practice. And Senegal is definitely one of these countries. Imagine in certain countries we cannot even ask in the course of the interview if a woman has been cut because it's too sensitive. So what we do, and I give you the example of Liberia, for instance, we ask whether the woman is part of a secret society, because being admitted to the secret society involves a rite of passage that is essentially the cutting of the genital parts.
So you interpret the answer to that question to mean that they've been cut?
As a proxy for being cut.
Mm-hmm.
So the women who have been initiated and are part of the secret societies needs to go through this rite of passage, which involves the cutting of the genital parts. So we take this as a proxy for the prevalence of female genital mutilation among women.
Now, how do you address the issue with the awareness? And do you think that awareness is enough to change something that's been happening for centuries? Or how is UNICEF and the United Nations going about this? First, it's in the news. I mean, first, let's go back. The unanimous adoption of the UN General Assembly resolution in December of 2012, calling for the complete elimination of it. And then we have your study that you authored released this week. What's, you know, from December to now July and then moving forward, because there's 30 million girls at risk of being cut if something doesn't change.
Mm-hmm. The adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of the resolution intensifying global efforts for the elimination of female genital mutilation mark a milestone in global efforts to end the practice. And the resolution was important because it demonstrated the political will of the international community to eliminate female genital mutilation and cutting. It also presented, if you want, a unified stance on how to move forward, drawing on years of experience in programming around the issue of female genital mutilation. What is important to understand is awareness of the risks associated with the practice is important, but is not sufficient.
Right.
In a country like Egypt, for instance, we asked women in 1995 whether they agreed with certain statements. One of the statements was, female genital mutilation is dangerous because it can lead to the death of a girl. At that time, in 1995, about 24% of girls and women of reproductive age responded, yes, I agree with this statement, demonstrating that they knew that there were risks associated with the practice. In 2008, we asked the same question again. And in 2008, almost half of the girls and women of reproductive age agreed with the statement. So there was an increase in the knowledge and awareness of the risk associated with the practice. But when we look at the prevalence and how the prevalence changed between 1995 and 2008, there was no much decline in the prevalence. The women are more aware of the risk associated with the practice, but they may still be unable to stop the cutting of the daughters. And this is because of the social pressure.
Well, it's
still a practice that is held in place by the belief that this is expected. There is an expectation that girls undergo the cutting.
And those are, in general, patriarchal countries. So how much do the women really actually have influence over making those kinds of critical social decisions?
Well, thanks to this report that was launched by UNICEF, we now know that many boys and men are actually against the practice of female genital mutilation. In certain countries, like Guinea, for instance, or Sierra Leone, there are more men against the continuation of the practice than women. So these defy, if you want, our assumptions and expectations around the practice of female genital mutilation. But the problem is girls and women do not know what boys and men think of the practice of female genital mutilation and cutting. In Egypt, one third of women and men admit not knowing what the opposite sex thought of the practice of female genital mutilation. So there is a little bit of a lack of communication and lack of knowledge about others, about what others think of the practice, particularly about what men think of the practice among women. And this lack of knowledge and communication is also relevant within families. We check the opinions of a wife and a husband within the same household to check if they had the same opinion vis-a-vis the continuation of the practice of female genital mutilation and cutting. And in countries like, again, Guinea or Sierra Leone, for instance, 50% of couples do not have the same opinions. So they have discordant opinions on whether or not the practice should continue. So this reinforced the argument that FGMC is fueled and continue to be kept in, to be kept in place because women do not know what other things, and women think that this is what is expected of them by their communities, by their husbands, and by, in some cases, by their religion. FGMC, female genital mutilation and cutting, is still seen by many women as a religious requirement, although it's nowhere written in the Islamic law or in any other religious edicts. This is not a religious requirement, but women think that it is.
But in your report, you said the prevalence is highest among Muslim girls and women.
Absolutely. It is higher in countries, Muslim countries, but is also found in other religious communities, including, for instance, among Christians. In certain countries, actually more common among Christians than among Islamic groups. So it can be found really across a multitude of religious communities.
So here we have this unanimous adoption by the UN General Assembly in December. Then we have this report that you authored now. And there are laws banning female genital mutilation at all ages that have been passed in the majority of African nations, and yet it still persists. So now what?
Well, it does persist, and it's true that we have intensified our global and national efforts to end FGMC, but this intensification has taken place mainly in the last decade. So this is a practice that has been in existence for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to have time to promote the abandonment of the practice. There are countries where the practice has almost disappeared in certain communities. If we think about the case of Kenya, for instance, in certain ethnic groups, like the Meru, for instance, 30 years ago, the practice affected more than half of girls and women of reproductive age. In 2008, another survey was conducted in Kenya. Girls, adolescent girls aged 15 to 19 were interviewed, and less than 5% of them declared that they had been cut. So over the course of essentially three decades, the practice of FGMC in certain ethnic groups in Kenya has disappeared. 30 years is a long time, if you want, but compared to centuries, where this practice has been taking place, it's nothing. So we can achieve the abandonment of the practice with appropriate strategies that include legislation, but also strategies that go beyond the legislation in these efforts of trying to promote awareness of the fact that many more and more girls and women and boys and men want this practice to end. But we need to break the social conventions. We need to break the sense of social obligation that keeps the practice in existence.
And it's not as if it's Western world trying to impose what they think is normal onto other countries, since it's a United Nations adoption, I would assume.
And you're correct. These many initiatives were actually the responsibility of local communities and national governments. So the last decade has witnessed a proliferation of initiatives that are led by the countries where the practice remains concentrated. And again, I want to bring the attention back to the data that are presented in this report that are new, is the fact that in the countries where FGMC, female genital mutilation and cutting, remains, women and men of these countries now say that they want this practice to stop.
So my question to you, Claudia, is I would think that in the countries such as Egypt, where it's almost 100%, wouldn't that be the best focus, is to go where it's the most egregious? Or do you start where it's getting more and more accepted not to do it, so that you can convert those that are already moving in that direction?
Evidence suggests that the decline in the practice is faster in countries and among communities where the prevalence is lower. And this is because practicing groups have an opportunity to interact with non-practicing groups, and they can see that there is an alternative. And the fact that girls are not cut in other groups does not mean stigma and discrimination. So it's important to look at the dynamics of practicing and non-practicing group, because exposure to non-practicing women is very important. Women with education, for instance, are significantly less likely to have their daughters cut, but they're also significantly less likely to support the continuation of the practice. And this is because of exposure. Educated girls have an opportunity to interact with girls from non-practicing community and witness that these girls who have not undergone female genital mutilation are still accepted in their communities. They are still able to find a husband, for instance.
And so what is there a concerted campaign, or how is it going to unfold now that you've identified what has happened, what progress has been made, what still are the challenges, and what can we do?
Well, through this report, we have an opportunity to go back to the countries and the communities where FGMC persists and show this growing level of opposition to the practice. UNICEF has an incredible advantage. We have a network of country offices and partners working in the communities where FGMC still persist. And the first things to do is now make sure that we make visible the fact that there is a growing number of girls and women who now want the practice to stop, as well as boys and men.
But I would imagine that the more remote, the more ignorant, as you mentioned, the more uneducated, the more difficult. And so you would have to have somebody in that community who has seen the light probably deal with that community, because they know their cultures, they're respected, they speak the language, mm-hmm. they understand the historical perspective, and yet they're trying to say, no, we need to stop this.
And so, this is exactly how UNICEF operates.
Okay.
We work at the community level with the leaders. Community leaders can be religious leaders or influential people in the community, so that they can be the ones facilitating the discussion among the members of the communities and the gradual abandonment of the practice. So everything is done at the community level, trying to involve key members of the different communities, with particular attention to those communities that you mentioned that are more isolated and have less opportunity to interact or to be exposed to activities and campaign around female genital mutilation and cutting.
Now, Claudia, earlier in our conversation, you talked about the traditional cutters that perform the procedures when they're not medicalized. Have those people been identified, and is there any way that you can educate them about what they're doing and how they might want to stop?
UNICEF has worked specifically in certain countries with traditional cutters, and they've become advocates against the continuation of the practice in certain countries, like in Gambia, for instance. We feature in our report the story of a traditional cutter who has decided to renounce the practice of female genital mutilation. It's important to say that stopping the traditional cutters from performing the procedure is not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot just operate at the level of the supply, if you
right.
want, for the procedure. We need to make sure that there is no demand for the cutting. Otherwise, what may happen is that the traditional cutters stop, but because the demand is still in place, new cutters emerge. And this may put girls at an increased risk, because the new cutters might have less experience.
Mm-hmm.
than the ones that have performed the practice for many years.
Claudia, do these cultures circumcise their boys?
It's not. The male circumcision and female circumcision do not necessarily go hand in hand.
So interesting. So they cut their girls but not their boys in general?
These are completely different practices, and female genital mutilation might exist in places where male circumcision is not taking place.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a gender issue.
It's a clear demonstration of manifestation of gender discrimination.
And I've always wondered how people can compare the two. I mean, I know cutting is cutting, but still, when you're talking about especially the infibulation, I mean, that's... I can't imagine. So what can we do for anybody who cares about this, listening to our conversation? How can we help?
Well, everybody has a role to play. The media have an important role to play, because they can disseminate the results of this survey and show this growing opposition against the practice of female genital mutilation, and they can also show that the practice is declining in a number of countries. So it's everybody, if you want, has something, a sort of contribution. And our contribution with this report was to show that with reliable data, you can now demonstrate that the practice is declining. And individual citizens, they can continue to support organizations like UNICEF, for instance, that try to convert the knowledge that we generate through this data collection into recommendation for policy and programming.
Can one donate to UNICEF and specify how the funds are used?
Absolutely. Then, well, the donations are received by our national committee for UNICEF. So I encourage those who would like to support UNICEF activity to donate to the U.S. fund for UNICEF.
But then within the U.S. fund for UNICEF, which we're going to post that contact information when we post this conversation, I'm asking specifically because I know with the American Red Cross, of which I'm a volunteer, you can earmark where your money goes. So I'm wondering if we donate to UNICEF, can we earmark that it goes towards your efforts of female genital mutilation awareness?
UNICEF runs on specific campaigns, and in the context of these campaigns, money can be specifically donated for a certain cause.
Okay.
And again, I encourage people to visit the website of UNICEF, the Global Fund for the U.S., where they can donate for UNICEF.
Okay. And then do you have now initiatives that you're going to move forward on that you know of based on the study that you authored?
Yes. UNICEF, together with UNFPA, are launching the second phase of a multi-country program for the abandonment of female genital mutilation and cutting. It's a program that was launched in 2008, so it completed the first phase. More than 17,000 communities have declared the abandonment of female genital mutilation and cutting, and now we are entering the second phase. We're also running an evaluation of the program that so far has indicated a very positive result of this joint activity that, again, is being launched by UNICEF together with the United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA.
United Nations Population
Funds.
Funds.
And UNFPA.
Did you say in 2008 that it's 17,000 communities?
Mm-hmm. That have declared the abandonment of the practice.
Nice.
So it's now been conducted in it was originally conducted in 15 countries, and then we have now launched. We are about to launch a second phase that will take place between 2014 and 2017. Initiatives are handled at the country level, and there are different approaches that are used. Because as I was saying earlier, FGMC is contextual, so it's important that strategies are developed country by country to make sure that we really tackle the main barriers towards the abandonment of the practice.
And Claudia, finally, how much is political in any of this?
I would say it's cultural.
Okay.
More than anything else. Obviously, it's important to have the support of key political figures in every country where we're trying to promote the abandonment of the practice. And we have indeed cases where political leaders have taken an important stand against the practice. I just want to mention the case of Burkina Faso, for instance, where the First Lady of Burkina Faso has been a very passionate advocate to promote the abandonment of the practice, not only in Burkina Faso, but also in the other countries in Africa where female genital mutilation still persists.
So I would think that that would help a lot, if, in other words, to keep it from being secret and secretive, but to give it the light of day and say, it's fine, it's enough. We once did that, and now we don't. We know better now, or, you know, whatever.
Absolutely. This is an important, it's an important step towards the abandonment of the practice, together with obviously legislative measures and community activities.
Claudia, anything else you'd like to add?
I just would like to thank you for the opportunity to talk about this report and this important issue.
Thank you so very much for your time and for all that you're doing. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend, Claudia.
Thanks, you too.
Yeah, thank you so much. Bye-bye. And that was Claudia Kappa. She is the Statistics and Monitoring Specialist at UNICEF. She is the author of the study that was released by UNICEF this week. And they said it's the largest report ever about the extent of female genital mutilation or cutting, which she refers to, if you heard, FGMC, so that's female genital mutilation or cutting, into the practice that affects tens of millions of women and girls worldwide. The reason that it's making news, not only this week, but because of what happened in December with the United Nations, is that if changes aren't made soon, there are going to be 30 million more girls who will have to go through this, I call it savagery, and I, you know, with all due respect to other cultures, but nevertheless, and if you heard her definition of what the most radical form of the practice as infibulation, where all the female organs or parts are removed, and then they sew it up, the genitalia, with a little hole so that they can urinate and menstruate. And I guess at some point she said that they can open it up so that they can have intercourse to procreate. So in the 29 countries in Africa and the Middle East, that's what this study was all about. And we're going to leave the program at that. Rather than go back into our news, I decided that I just wanted to make this be the focus of today's program because of the severity and the enormity of it. So we wish you a fabulous weekend. We thank you so much for the honor and privilege of being able to provide you with some information. We're going to play the jingle, and we will see you on Monday.
Give you something.